This was a major breach of trust, and I'm really sorry that this happened.
Facebook caught playing fast and loose with personal data big time. Is this a turning point for the social network we all hate to love and love to hate?
If you took China and you added the entire population of America, and then you added the entire population of America again, that is Facebook.
Our brains are constantly being commandeered by these technologies that have been reverse engineered to addict us.
One of the funniest things about the coverage of the story is that those who know the least about ads are the most convinced of the supernatural powers of advertising and what Cambridge Analytica did. And those who most know ads are the ones who are most skeptical of their claims.
The problem with Mark Zuckerberg is he's deeply uneducated. He seems not to have considered the terrible things that human beings can and have done to each other.
We have a basic responsibility to protect people's data. And if we can't do that, then we don't deserve to have the opportunity to serve people.
Like it or not, it's all coming up after this. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Late last week, the New York Times and the Observer of London released the results of a months-long investigation into the political data firm Cambridge Analytica. The story was delicious, and the cast of characters straight out of a Bond movie. There was the wealthy arch-conservative puppet master.
They had the money from billionaire Republican backer Robert Mercer and his daughter Rebecca.
His man on the inside,
Steve Bannon, oversaw Cambridge Analytica's collection of Facebook data.
The arrogant operative caught red-handed in a sting.
The videos show a reporter posing as a prospective client of Cambridge Analytica and executives bragging about using bribes and prostitutes to entrap politicians.
The guilt-stricken whistleblower.
I was naive. I made a big mistake, and that's why I'm talking to you.
And we were naive, too. Or at least the 50 million of us Facebook users who were touched by the Cambridge Analytica scandal when our personal information was divulged by Facebook without our consent and maybe weaponized against us during the campaign. Many talking heads saw these revelations as the answer to the question that had long plagued them, namely, how did Donald Trump defy all expectations and win the presidency? It was the data, stupid.
Did Cambridge Analytica win the election for the president? And were laws broken along the way?
A psychological warfare weapon, something you say Steve Bannon wanted, the ability to play with the psychology of an entire country.
It's what Cambridge Analytica does. It kind of identifies the kinds of voters who might be vulnerable to persuasion, some might say manipulation.
Antonio Garcia Martinez used to work at Facebook as a product manager heading its ad targeting business. He's now a contributing writer for Wired, where he recently reported on the age-old marketing tool that Cambridge Analytica claims to have used to direct Trump campaign ads to susceptible voters, psychographics.
Yeah, one of the funniest things about the coverage of the story is that those who know the least about ads are the most convinced of the supernatural powers of advertising and what Cambridge Analytica did. And those, like me or some of my colleagues, who most know ads are the ones who are most skeptical of their claims.
On Facebook, drawing psychographic profiles has involved quiz apps that supposedly tell you what kind of personality you have or which Beatle or Harry Potter character you most resemble. But it all boiled down to the same thing.
You know, this whole psychographic thing, it's kind of a riff on demographics, but it, instead of being age and gender and geography, it refers to a certain psychological state of being that presumably the target of your ad is somehow in, which gives that person an affinity for your product or, in this case, you know, political philosophy.
Antonio Garcia Martinez is a contributor to Wired, a former Facebook product manager and author of Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune, and Random Failure in Silicon Valley.
The model that they used is what's called the Big Five personality model. You can actually look it up on Wikipedia. Ocean is the handy mnemonic for five dimensions that you project a human personality on, and those are openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. And the idea here being that if you're neurotic, you're either going to feel strongly about guns or immigration or as the case may be. And so by breaking somebody down into one of these five categories, you can figure out whether they'd react positively or negatively to a certain political message. That's the thought, at least.
Before marketers had actual real-time consumer behavior data in hand, they segmented consumers based on general demographic similarities, neighborhood and media habits, and so on. It's not complete baloney, is it?
Yeah, I don't think it's completely wrong. Again, if you refer to one of the classic psychographic models, it's called the PRISM with a Z segments, now owned by Nielsen, and you'll find there a mythology of 66 types of American consumer. And yeah, if you read it, you'll recognize yourself in some of them in the same way that you kind of read your horoscope and think it's true. But it has such gems like shotguns and pickups, for example, as the sort of white working class rural voter. There's kids in cul-de-sacs as the sort of middle class suburban family. The idea behind this model is, and in fact, what happened with Cambridge Analytica is, you know, one of their researchers in a slightly freelance capacity created a Facebook app, something like 300,000 Facebook users. They had to opt in via Facebook's platform. And then based on the questions in that quiz, that person tried to figure out what sort of Facebook data is associated with, for example, neuroticism or openness or conscientiousness or the various dimensions of his model. And then armed with that, you sort of guesstimate, well, what sort of personality profile, for example, feels strongly about immigration or gun control or Trump or as the case may be, and then turn around and try to target that person on Facebook via the ad system.
You would think that joining even these kind of rough-hewn psychographic profiles with the other data sets that Facebook has would really, as Cambridge Analytica claims, really sharpen that low-res image into something deeply personal and illuminating.
Well, at Cambridge, we've rolled out a long-form quantitative instrument to probe the underlying traits that inform personality.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I think people tend to overestimate how much actual actionable, targetable data they have. The only thing you can actually target on Facebook are things like age and gender, which are admittedly important, but are still kind of, you know, basic. Geography, obviously. And then what's known as interests. It's mostly basically what pages you've liked. And while that might be of interest to some marketers, the fact that you've liked, say, BMW's page on Facebook doesn't mean you're actually in market for a BMW, right? Which is the discovery we made in 2011 when we built a lot of these technologies and we realized that they actually weren't working for most marketers. Even assuming you do a poll on someone, how do you actually find a neurotic person on Facebook, right? I want to find someone who wants to buy a BMW, or I want to find someone who's neurotic because a neurotic person is anti-immigration. How do you then go around and find that person on Facebook? The challenge is still the same. Of course, if you have voter rolls, if you have other, you know, either third-party or first-party data, you can bring that to Facebook. But Facebook's data itself, I think people tend to overestimate how much value there actually is in their targeting data.
I guess I don't have to take your word for that. This is Alexander Kogan, the PhD researcher at the heart of this Cambridge Analytica story, the guy who was accused of misappropriating the Facebook data, speaking to the BBC this week.
In practice, my best guess is that we were 6 times more likely to get everything wrong about a person as we were to get everything right about a person. Like, I personally don't think micro-targeting is an effective way to use such data sets.
You don't think it could sway an election?
I think it could have only hurt the campaign.
The Trump campaign, you mean?
Any campaign. I think what Cambridge Analytica has tried to sell is magic, and they've made claims that this is incredibly accurate and it tells you everything there is to tell about you, but I think the reality is it's not that. If you sit down and you really work through the statistics, those claims quickly fall apart.
I mean, obviously, Kogan might be kind of backpedaling there, given all the attention his work has garnered, but the reality is, particularly in the political space, it's often very difficult to figure out if something actually works, right? When you're selling shoes online, it's relatively easy to show you an ad for shoes, and then if you go and buy those shoes, to actually connect those two things together and actually look at the return on your investment in advertising. No campaign, no matter how well-founded or sophisticated, can actually really tell if their campaign drove voters to the ballot box and made them vote or not.
So the last few days, you've been making the media rounds explaining why the secret sauce wasn't either secret or particularly saucy. But, you know, at least a year ago, The New York Times ran a story saying that very same thing. We also learned that the Ted Cruz presidential campaign ditched the models because they were unreliable. So why do you suppose that you were at pains to go through this yet again?
To be honest, people would rather believe that dark, mysterious forces using some diabolical technology made evil happen rather than, you know, a more mundane story. You know, I actually made a sort of joke tweet about that. You know, what are we going to believe? That the center-left parties in the U.S. and the U.K. were pathetically complacent in reacting to global capitalism and spurred a populist revolt that caused Trump and Brexit to happen? Or do we believe the protocols of the elders of Facebook story, where somehow ad targeting came out of nowhere and elected a, you know, an autocrat. And everyone's just like, two all the way, right? Two is the one that we're going to go with. I think there's other forces here more than the reality of it that's causing all this media attention.
Okay, that's one of the week's journalistic misdirections, the red herring. Part two is what we've missed about Facebook that the Trump campaign absolutely did exploit to run what turned out to be an astonishingly efficient social media campaign. It has to do with the Facebook algorithm, and this is really kind of remarkable, the actual cash value of being inflammatory. Please explain, for starters, the auction bidding system.
Right. This is a key part of how this whole mediascape works that the public doesn't understand and frankly should. So how does the auction process work? I think the best way might be explaining it via metaphor with the regular feed, which I think most people understand. In newsfeed, you're obviously not seeing all the stories and posts and shares that all your friends have put out there. Facebook actually ranks them for you because otherwise it would be a torrent of information that you can't parse. And so Facebook uses a model, an algorithm, that calculates how likely you are to engage with that piece of content. And by engage, we mean share it yourself, click on it, comment on it. Anything you interact with, they will tend to show you more of. What I think people don't understand is that that same dynamic plays out on the advertising side. In other words, Facebook also calculates, based on what it knows about you, which ads you're likely to interact with. Ads on Facebook are not just like ads in a newspaper on TV. They often appear as a regular Facebook story, right? So you can share them, you can comment on them. It appears like a regular post inside your feed. What I think people don't realize is that that engagement metric affects whether that ad's going to show up in your feed and also how much that ad ends up costing to the advertiser.
And weirdly, it costs the advertiser less if people click on it more.
Exactly, because at the end of the day, Facebook is optimizing for what in the trade is called CPM. That's cost per mil, cost per thousand ads. After all is said and done, a politician or a product or whatever that embraces a rhetorical strategy that, for better or worse, causes lots of engagement, they will either get more media for the same amount of money or get the same media for less money than they otherwise would if they weren't sort of clickbaity.
So if I understand this right, the business model of valuing engagement actually offers an advantage to incendiary ads and so-called fake news, right?
Yes, to the extent that negative rhetoric drives more engagement than, say, more nuanced or tempered rhetoric, then indeed it would fare better on the Facebook ad system, yes.
Okay, that's one thing that the Trump campaign exploited about Facebook. Another is something that you were in charge of, a feature called custom audiences, and later something called lookalike audiences. Explain how they leveraged their investment with them.
Right. Custom audiences is sort of a fancy marketing name for Facebook joining to the outside world of data. I mean, a simple example of this that all of your listeners have probably had, if you go browse the internet and you go shop for something or whatever, and you go back to Facebook and you see that same pair of shoes or that same handbag you were shopping for appear inside Facebook, that's what I mean. There's this outside world of data that historically didn't enter Facebook, but starting in 2012, there was a couple different technologies. One of them was custom audiences that allowed that to happen. Effectively, what happens is the advertiser quite literally uploads a spreadsheet with names, email addresses, phone numbers, etc., and then Facebook tries to find those users inside Facebook. It's probably the most common tool that savvy advertisers with lots of data use on Facebook. So what would that mean in the political context? Well, voter files, for example, that I understand have things like names and addresses, could be uploaded to Facebook. Donors who actually donated money to Trump, all of those people, like at an individual granular level, would be targetable on Facebook. On top of that comes the second product you mentioned, which is lookalike audiences. And this addresses a really deep need for most advertisers. Most advertisers have some set of customers or voters that they know are into their brand or into their products. Question is, how do I find more of them? And so after I've uploaded a custom audience, and again, that's based on my email list, people who have come to my site, Facebook then finds people who are like that. And here is where the true value of Facebook's data comes in. It turns out, you know, what they care about is not your photos or your conversations with your coworkers or your partner. What they really care about and what they use their data for is figuring out other people who are like you. That's a key thing. I mean, the reality is if you've got five friends, more than likely they have the same consumption patterns or the same political views that you do. And via the magic of Facebook data, you can expand an initial targeting list into a yet bigger one.
Okay, so is this just marketers and politicians using finer and finer targeting as they'd be expected to? Or is all of this data overlaying, the data joining, whether by businesses or candidates or governments, putting us all at a high risk of utter loss of privacy?
I think you put your finger on it. You know, even I, former ad tech mercenary that I am or was, I'm willing to concede that I think politics is definitely special, right? Selling you on Brexit is different than selling you on a pair of shoes. And if the government sees fit to regulate political advertising differently than it does regular advertising, that's not the craziest thing in the world. And so if what comes out of this whole Cambridge blow-up is that the rules that typically apply to conventional media and political advertising also apply to Facebook, I think that would be just fine. But, you know, once you've taken this genie out of the bottle or this toothpaste out of the tube, it's hard to put back in. And so I don't see politicians who, by the way, are themselves the ones who would cook up the regulation, regulating the very thing that put them in power.
Antonio, thank you very much.
No, thanks for trying to clarify this. It's amazing how the press's coverage of this has gone in so many directions.
Antonio Garcia Martinez is a contributor to Wired, a former Facebook product manager and author of Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune and Random Failure in Silicon Valley. The toothpaste is indeed out of the tube. But as University of Virginia Media Studies professor Siva Vaidyanathan wrote this week in Slate, Facebook started squeezing that tube years ago.
App developers for a long time could get access to tremendous collections of data about millions of Facebook users at any given time. This was standard practice and policy at Facebook between at least 2010 and 2015. And that seems to have been lost in the story because the Cambridge Analytica story is such a great spy novel. It has this idea that there's brainwashing and manipulation going on, right? That's almost irresistible. For years, we've been raising these issues and everyone's been saying, where's the harm? Well, here we are. We're finally at that moment.
There is this impulse in the press, because Cambridge Analytica has mainly arch-conservative clients, including briefly the Trump campaign, and because the Mercer family has such a big stake in the company, to portray all of this as the latest evil manipulation from the far right. But Obama used approximately the same techniques, no?
Now, in 2008, Facebook was pretty new. And the idea was, this is where the youngsters are, right? This is long before my mom joined Facebook. And so Barack Obama spent a lot of time interacting with people on Facebook. There were Facebook groups devoted to supporting Obama. And he bought a lot of ads on Facebook before that was a thing to do. So he was the Facebook candidate. And then by 2012, the Obama campaign developed an app that sucked out all of the data, the same kinds of data that Cambridge Analytica now has been using to allegedly profile voters, right? A lot of us were concerned about this in 2012, and it was really hard to get anyone to care. All the stories that came out were about the digital savvy of the Obama campaign. After the Obama campaign, Facebook decided, let's take all this in-house. Let's become the political consultant to the world. You have to go to Facebook. Cambridge Analytica claimed to be able to profile people by personality type, which is about as useful as profiling people by astrological sign. There is no evidence that you can move behavior just because you tag people with a relative score for openness or conscientiousness or neuroticism, right? Isn't it better just to know someone really cares about gun rights or really cares about abortion? That can move a voter. And that's what Facebook gives people.
Can you tell me what Facebook is allowed to do and what it's not allowed to do with the data it collects?
Facebook got in big trouble back in 2011. The Federal Trade Commission got some complaints from Facebook users and from some privacy organizations. They were worried that all of these application developers that had tied themselves on to Facebook, Farmville, Mafia Wars or Words with Friends, those games were sucking out all kinds of important data from people's Facebook profiles. And that's because when you signed up to use these games, you gave them permission to look at your profile and take out basic information. What was not clear was that you were also granting these games permission to take out all the information about your friends. That was something that the Federal Trade Commission wanted to call a halt to. So in 2011, they got Facebook to agree to a consent decree. And that consent decree basically said, look, Facebook, you can't have this sort of activity where friends' data also gets exported. You also have to get explicit permission from people when they interact with apps that are going to take their data out.
beyond that, they put the burden on Facebook to make sure that when that data exits Facebook, it doesn't go to a fourth party. And if people cancel their Facebook accounts, that Facebook goes out into the field and makes sure that those game developers, those app developers, those personality quiz developers, those political campaigns like the Obama campaign in 2012, that those developers remove the data from their collections. So this was something Facebook agreed to do under penalty of law back in 2011. But clearly, Facebook did not institute a program to make sure that your data would disappear if you deleted it from Facebook. Facebook did not enforce contracts with third-party app developers to make sure that fourth parties like Cambridge Analytica didn't get that data.
So Zuckerberg, after disappearing from public view for 3 or 4 days, on Wednesday issues a memo and goes on CNN with Anderson Cooper and sits for a Q&A with the New York Times in a sort of mea culpa, saying, you know, we let this stuff get away from us. We didn't closely audit these third parties like app developers who have possession of all of this extremely personal data. But it seemed to me he was shifting the blame to them for breaking the deals that they signed instead of taking responsibility for all this going on. You have seen Facebook operate in the public eye now for more than 10 years. Do you think that he was being straight with the New York Times and CNN and all of us?
You know, Zuckerberg promised to install a bunch of new safeguards for user privacy. He didn't get into detail, but just looking at the outline of what he said would happen, I can't help wondering if Facebook wasn't already going to do all these things. Because in August, European law is going to require a much higher level of scrutiny and many more restrictions on how companies like Facebook operate with our data. They have a whole new set of laws coming into effect. It's going to change how all of these companies operate in Europe. And anybody whose data gets exported to Europe, or anybody who communicates with anyone in Europe, meaning Americans, you know, they're going to be protected by European law as well. So I suspect that all that Zuckerberg was promising yesterday is stuff that Facebook was already planning to do to deal with European law. Right now, his biggest concern is Congress.
If these issues have existed for the whole history of Facebook, and if the company has signed consent agreements and it has the capacity to do all of the things that Zuckerberg on Wednesday claimed to be now undertaking, you have to wonder, well, why hasn't it actually done this stuff till now? Is it because it's antithetical to its business model?
Yeah, there's only two things wrong with Facebook, what it is and what it does, right? So what it demands of us is our attention. It wants us hooked. Really, the company is geared around the fact that there is a true belief at the core of the company and in Mark Zuckerberg's heart and soul that the more time we spend on Facebook, the better we will be to each other. It's a missionary model, right? It's an almost faith-based model. Thousands of years of human history notwithstanding, Mark Zuckerberg believes that the more we interact with each other, the better we will be to each other.
Do you think he's really that messianic, or that that's just a rationalization for the business model, which is more like the heroin dealer's business model?
It is antithetical to Facebook's business model. It's antithetical to the dominant business model of Silicon Valley. It's also antithetical to the ideology of Mark Zuckerberg. And I think Mark Zuckerberg is a true believer in Facebook. I see no reason to doubt his sincerity. He's a deeply intelligent and sincere person who cares a lot about the state of the world. The problem with Mark Zuckerberg is he's deeply uneducated. He seemed to have started on this route without pondering the terrible things that human beings can and have done to each other. He seems not to have considered the possibility that our hard problems are not merely solved by proximity and connection. It's a naive ideology that he holds, but it's actually pretty pervasive in Silicon Valley, because it was pervasive in the hacker communities of the 1990s from which he emerged. This notion that if ideas and information flow freely and without friction, suddenly we would all know more and food would taste better. I mean, this was a serious line of thought in the 1990s. And it's still with us. You can still see it in the core ideologies of Google and Facebook and 100 other companies. The last 2 years should have shaken him out a bit. But, you know, he still spends too much time having lunch with Henry Kissinger in Davos and not enough time reading Aristotle or reading National Geographic, for that matter, right? And seeing the ways in which the world is a lot more complex place than he allows.
We now have had more than 10 years of experience of Facebook letting private data get into third-party hands. And for marketers and governments and criminals to have a ever higher resolution picture of ourselves. This is not new. And yet we continue to have this conversation.
It doesn't mean it has to be that way. It doesn't mean that they have to call the shots for the world. Our great hope lies in our activity as citizens, demanding that our regulators and our legislators take this problem seriously. But I just don't see how Facebook can deeply confront the wide variety of problems facing it and the wide variety of problems that it has caused in the world without looking at its core functions, its advertising system, its data gathering system, its algorithm. And once you do that, you basically have to dismantle Facebook if you want to address these problems in a serious way.
Siva, thank you very much.
Sure.
Siva Vaidyanathan is a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia. His forthcoming book, Anti-Social Media, will be published in September.
Coming up, we revisit the old argument over new tech. The internet, threat or menace?
Yes, this is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Wednesday, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg finally addressed the mounting controversy on CNN, suggesting that some regulation might not be so bad after all.
I actually am not sure we shouldn't be regulated. I actually think the question is more, what is the right regulation rather than yes or no, should it be regulated?
A new Zuckerberg or just a bit of saving face? Either way, it's a far cry from the Zuck we thought we knew, the technologist far more interested in effectively supplanting the government than submitting to it. In his newest book, World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech, Franklin Foer places Facebook in the history of techno-utopian enterprises that began following the French Revolution. Zuckerberg, he writes, is the heir to a long political tradition. Over the last 200 years, the West has been unable to shake an abiding fantasy, a dream sequence in which we throw out the bum politicians and replace them with engineers. Rule by slide rule.
That dream that somehow we could automate reason. So after the incredible chaos of the French Revolution, Western society started to crave order. They started to crave lives that were less chaotic, less wild, better organized. And so there was the rise of a thinker called Auguste Comte, who wanted to have societies, governments, actually run by engineers. Mark Zuckerberg preached this beautiful philosophy that he was helping engineer the world so that the world would be better connected. And through our interconnections, we would understand one another better. We would become more peaceful. He said that he wanted to remove the friction from life. And that's one of the great dreams of technology, that we would have these companies that would be able to anticipate our wants and needs, and they would supply them to us. And that's exactly what he tried to do. He created this contraption called the News Feed that took all of our data and it tried to use that data to figure out the things that gave us pleasure, to figure out the things that gave us anxiety, in order to provide hierarchy to the information that we consumed.
You say the source of Facebook's power, Silicon Valley's power, is the algorithm. Is the algorithm the problem?
What is an algorithm? Algorithm, in a way, is the distillation of the engineering dream. This idea that you could just come up with an automated, robotic way of dealing with the messy complexities of human life. But I think the problem is the hubris that's embedded in that approach. This idea that we can find the perfect scientific solution to things sometimes just gives too much power to the people who are in charge of the system. And sometimes the people in charge of the system, they like to say that they're running things in the name of science, but really they're running a company to make a profit. And I think that's part of the Zuckerberg delusion, was that he presented himself as somebody who was governing his system in the name of reason, but in fact, he was really trying to addict us to his platform and make as much money as possible.
You wrote, even as an algorithm mindlessly implements its procedures and learns to see new patterns in the data, it reflects the minds of its creators, the motives of its trainers. Computer scientists, you wrote, talk about torturing the data until it confesses. What is it that the computer engineer wants the data to say?
The engineer is coming at it with a whole set of assumptions. And there's a whole lot of social scientific work that shows that algorithms can replicate some of the racial and gender biases of the engineers who create the algorithms.
So these algorithms are not neutral parties in themselves. And they continuously study us and ultimately decide a lot of things for us. And you're frightened that we are outsourcing our thinking to the organizations that run the machines. But what else is new? We always knew that, right?
Apparently not. I think that what we see in these recent controversies over Facebook is that we largely accepted Facebook's own view of itself. We thought, all right, well, maybe that data is being used to influence us in some abstract sort of way. But it's one thing to think that in a distant sort of way, but then it's quite another to see the ways in which that data, that process, could be weaponized and turned against us.
You quoted in your article that 60% of people, according to the best research, are completely unaware of the existence of the algorithm?
It's true. When people look at their news feed, they go along with the myth that Facebook perpetuates, that it's just your friends sharing information. But of course it's not that. It's being organized and it's being sorted and it's being given hierarchy. And in that hierarchy, there is a hidden agenda to commandeer as much of our attention as possible.
We have a hidden agenda too, Frank.
I know you do.
We want you to talk about free will, which we've been digging into a bit lately. You've argued that algorithms are meant to erode it and to relieve human beings of the burden of choosing. So tell me, what's at stake here?
Human beings are both incredibly powerful and incredibly weak. And our weaknesses are exploited by people all the time. But as society, we constantly try to fight back. And so we create rules. We don't like subliminal advertising. We try to impose transparency as much as possible. And we do these things because we believe in our power to make good decisions in a democracy. And so we protect our capacity to make those decisions.
You wrote that it's Zuckerberg's fantasy that this data might be analyzed to uncover the mother of all revelations, a fundamental mathematical law underlying human social relationships that governs the balance of who and what we all care about. It's scary to think that something like that actually exists.
I don't think it exists. I think, though, it reflects everything that we've been saying about this dream of having the engineer take care of us. And you see it as there's this arms race right now to create personal assistants. Each of the big tech companies wants to have what Zuckerberg has called a butler that wakes us up in the morning and that guides us through our day. These companies, because of their data and because of their algorithms, would be able to offload all these decisions that we make over the course of the day. And on the one hand, wouldn't all of us like to free up our time to do things that would provide us with a true state of leisure and we could pursue the things that make us our best selves? But on the other hand, we may wake up one day and we'd say, holy cow, we've given up all this power and we find ourselves trapped in patterns of consumption that we dislike. And maybe the control that we've given up has actually made us stupider than we were going in, because our brains are constantly being commandeered by these notifications, these distractions, by these technologies that have been reverse engineered to essentially addict us. And so when we lose the time and space and the ability to contemplate the world, I don't think we make good decisions, especially democratic decisions. I worry that it makes us less capable of being spiritual human beings. I worry that it makes us less present in the course of our conversations. And I don't think that those threats are actually theoretical ones. I think that we all toil with our addictions to devices.
And so do you think we've approached a moment when we can stop and consider what we have wrought or what has been wrought upon us or what we have participated in wreaking?
Yeah, to me, that's part of the thrilling undercurrent of the backlash against Facebook right now, which is that you have a lot of people who are collectively awakening to the fact that our privacy has been invaded and that we want it back, that we've been wasting our time on this platform. It's exciting to see people taking agency.
Or is it just the kinds of things that addicts say along the line of, I'll quit tomorrow?
You're right that people can be delusional and thinking that they've broken the addiction when it's just a prelude to another binge. But in this case, I do think that we're making good arguments about this to ourselves. We've drifted with things for a really long time without really reflecting on what we're doing. And so we're not going to give up our phones, but maybe we'll proceed in a way in which we're a little bit more self-conscious about how we use our time, about the things that we surrender to these companies, and we start to claw back a little bit of space in our lives.
Frank, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Franklin Foer is a national correspondent for The Atlantic and the author of World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech.
Coming up, the future of Facebook.
This is On the Media.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It's too early to estimate the impact of the Cambridge Analytica scandal on Facebook or on the rest of the tech platforms now mining and selling every nanosecond of our lives. But one can't help but feel that whether through legislation, regulation, or customer revolt, something's got to give.
It may seem as if it were ever thus, but it wasn't. In fact, back in October of 2012, I spoke to author, educator, and all-round new media visionary Clay Shirky about whether Facebook's rising star would ever fall. And he said,
it's hard to guess how long Facebook will be around. I mean, everything ends at some point. But I don't think that there's any foreseeable future in which Facebook goes away or even becomes significantly smaller or less important than it currently is. Make a list of their advantages. Enormous user base, incredible economies of scale, world-class infrastructure. Advertisers are tripping over themselves to get involved. No one wants to call themselves a competitor. Now make a list of their disadvantages, right? A handful of privacy nuts are cranky. Can you think of a second thing to add to that list? I can't.
Well, 5.5 years later, we figured you could think of a few more, right?
No, absolutely. The list has gotten longer.
You know, the challenge that Facebook faces is because they're operating in a scale that no one has ever even really thought about before.
It was an unprecedented scale when we talked in 2012.
But it was at least a scale that was similar in size to nation states. Now there are not even countries as large as Facebook. 2 billion monthly unique users. If you took China and you added the entire population of America, and then you added the entire population of America again, that is Facebook. It's now operating at such a scale that ordinary people can't think through the ramifications of what could go wrong.
Aside from just scale, how did they get themselves in this position? I think they've played fast and loose with the data with absolutely no consequences.
The playing fast and loose question really comes down to legality versus ethics. Every click-through license you've never read for every piece of software you want to use has basically committed your firstborn. I mean, right. No one reads those documents. And this is where I think Facebook is in trouble now, is cold comfort to people who regard what Cambridge Analytica is doing as being possibly legal but definitely wrong. I still think Facebook is not going away. They will have to be regulated. They'll have to change some of their business practices. But as many people have been pointing out, just leave Facebook is not an option for many people. The idea that, oh, you can just quit and be part of your small community. You know, a friend of mine is saying, look, I have a rare disease and Facebook has been absolutely invaluable as a support group, as an information group. And the problem Facebook continues to solve is not the problem of helping people talk in groups. The problem Facebook solves is finding people to talk to in the first place.
Right.
And that service remains intact. There is a degree of American narcissism here. If the FTC were to come to some consent decree with Facebook that said, you must delete the profiles of all U.S. users, their total population would go down by just a shade over 10%. Mm-hmm. 90% of that company operates outside of the United States.
Then let's talk about outside the United States. We know that Europe has imposed certain controls on Facebook's use of data that we have declined to do.
Right.
But of course, they're going to have to be subject to at least the European regulations, and those will have an impact on many American users, or won't it?
Germany is now in the position vis-a-vis data what California does for auto regulations. When California sets minimum standards, car makers just say, look, if we're going to have to do it for California, we might as well have to do it for the whole United States. Germany is now in the position of being willing to enforce data regulations that spread over a large enough area because of the EU expansion that it will effectively rein in Facebook.
For all of us?
For all of us. You know, the miracle of Facebook is it's the 6 degrees of separation model now globally. At some point, if I start saying, oh, these regulations only touch the friends of your friends' friends, that's a bunch of people in Europe already. And so having to tighten that up will mean that the whole network becomes less fluid for advertisers and more protective of what the users expect out of that service.
You always seem to me to be the ultimate tech optimist. You know, you believe that the internet had the potential to be a liberating and democratizing force that would transform governments, the way some people feel about capitalism. Do you still feel optimistic?
I am much more narrowly optimistic, as I think anyone looking at this environment would be. Many of the things that I and many other people were optimistic about in the last decade, and people saying, no, that'll never happen, have not only happened, they've been folded into the background. We now all take Wikipedia for granted. You can't even get a fight going over Wikipedia anymore. What I did not know, and I think, you know, few of us knew, is this ability to concentrate hatred and being able to magnify it at this scale, I had underestimated. But I will say, again, that the United States is only a small part of this now. And when you see, for instance, what's going on in Zimbabwe or what's going on in South Korea, both of which are having moments of emerging out from under control by autocratic regimes, one democratically elected but autocratically minded, one genuinely autocratic, you absolutely see the ability to coordinate resistance to those regimes as being part of that story. So there's a degree to which I can be, I think, both very pessimistic about my country without thinking the story that's going on in the United States is the same as the story that's going on everywhere in the mm-hmm. world.
So what do you think? Do you think that Congress and or the FTC will try to take some action? Do you think that this is a Facebook world and it'll always be a Facebook world and Mark Zuckerberg will say he's real sorry and just continue doing what he's always done?
This moment feels different, but there is no will in a Republican-led Congress to force Facebook to create a more skeptical environment. I think Congress would tolerate an environment in which fewer things went viral, and when they went viral, they spread less quickly and less far. That, I think, is going to be the net result of this.
How do you do that?
You tone down the parts of the algorithm that look for the hottest, newest, most emotionally driving stuff. The speed with which the ice bucket challenge spread through Facebook was a result of a whole bunch of engineering choices about, oh, people seem to like these videos. We're going to prioritize them. You can dial it up or down, and I think Facebook may end up dialing it down.
But that will cost Facebook time spent online and thus money.
Right. The interesting question, and this is the one that Zuckerberg himself has opened up, is time spent online the right metric to be optimizing for any longer? Because in fact, Facebook is so far out in front that they may be able to worry more about whether or not they are slowly wearing out their existing users because they can't double their user base. They literally can't. With China locking Facebook out and much of the people that they could pick up next essentially waiting for the economic tide to get them smartphones, Facebook is at roughly the scale it will be operating at for the next several years.
So where does it go? How does it change?
So it could potentially change in the direction of user loyalty rather than simply squeezing every minute out of every day. It means taking a hit to revenue, and it's not clear that a public company would ever do that, even if it's obviously the right thing, unless a government made it clear that the alternative was going to be much worse. And that's where I think regulation comes in. Regulation is the stick that potentially lets Facebook say, if we just slow things down and we stop treating all conversation as being, you know, potentially substitutable. So when you meet somebody at a party who keeps going on and on about the Federal Reserve, either letting that person into your kitchen to yell at you and three friends or giving them a megaphone to reach a million people, that feels really weird, which is essentially what Facebook now does.
How do they prevent that?
What they have to do is to make what's called the first neighborhood, which is really literally just you and your friends, not the next ring out, be more of a defensive cordon than it currently is. Right now, they regard the first neighborhood, you and all your friends, as being, here's a list of doorways to Brooke. So if anything comes through any of these doorways, we can also get to Brooke. If instead you start thinking of the first neighborhood the way it works in the offline world, here's a list of bodyguards for Brooke. They will only forward to her things they think she's actually interested in. You end up with much less content moving through the network. You end up with much less clickbaity content moving through the network. But you may end up in a world in which you and your friends have tighter relations on Facebook, and the kind of friends of a friend's, everybody's seen this stuff, falls into the middle distance.
And that's a good thing. Because it sounds like super cocooning to me.
Yeah, there are places where you should go out in public and be exposed to points of view and have to defend your own and whatever else. But those people should not be able to follow you into your home. Constantly demanding that people engage in a conversation they don't want to have so they become exhausted and remove themselves from the public sphere. So we need filter bubbles because we need some place to talk with people who agree with us, partly to rest, partly because some ideas are better worked out among people who see eye to eye. And we need a public sphere where we can smash our ideas against each other and see which bits fly off. Right now, you see people who have political malfeasance in mind constantly trying to take large-scale patterns of argumentation and inject it into the small scale. You see this on Reddit, the giant collection of discussion boards, when politically minded groups go on raids where they simply attack people on other boards, flooding them with people who disagree with them in order to disrupt the ability for those people to talk among themselves. Unsurprisingly, boards having to do with feminism, boards having to do with racism, et cetera, people trying to discuss these issues in need of social response will often get flooded by the alt-right, not trying to argue with them, but simply trying to prevent them from even having the conversation. So we need small-scale cocoons and we need large-scale public spheres. And right now, they may now be in a position where they face enough regulatory threat that they would start doing things that would voluntarily give up some of the addictive qualities of Facebook in favor of some of the qualities that my friend Jillian was talking about, of I have a disease and it's interesting for me to meet other people who suffer from this rare condition. You know, that's the baby that you don't want to throw out with the bathwater. But people with rare diseases don't need virality. You don't need things to move at lightning speed across hundreds of millions of people to find other people who are similar to you that you might want to talk to.
Thank you, Clay.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you, Brooke.
You're still an optimist.
You know, you call me a tempered optimist, yes.
Clay Shirky is the Vice Provost of Educational Technology at NYU.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, Michael Loewinger, and Leah Fetter. We had more help from John Hanrahan, Philip Yiannopoulos, and Isaac Napel. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Greg Rippon.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Like me on Facebook. No, don't.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.